Hi, I'm Brianna Contreras, Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Hello, I'm Peter Werwein. I'm Senior Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Welcome to MHE Talks, Improving Patient Access, a new podcast series part of our Tuning into the C-Suite podcast from Managed Healthcare Executive.
Patient access is a challenge that everyone in healthcare seems to have been talking about for decades. It's one of those big tent problems of American healthcare, a topic that takes in everything from practical problems like transportation to a doctor's appointment, or maybe in today's telehealth era, spotty Wi-Fi. There are also financial barriers to access, such as high out-of-pocket costs, and structural barriers, such as deeply rooted healthcare disparities and racism.
Our new podcast, MHE Talks, Improving Patient Access, will feature healthcare leaders and executives who are working to pull down the barriers to patient access. The goal is to have a lively, informative conversation about a foundational issue in American healthcare.
Well, hello everybody. My name is Peter Werwein, and I am Senior Editor at Managed Healthcare Executive. And today I have the pleasure of speaking with Mohan Giridharadas, who is CEO and founder of a company called LeanTOS. They're out in Northern California. So thanks for joining us this morning, or joining me more precisely.
Good to be here, Peter.
So I don't imagine the world at large knows much about you or your background. So maybe just fill us in a little bit about you and your career, and then we'll talk about LeanTOS.
Terrific. I have a background in computer science and in business. And I started my business career by joining McKinsey in 91. I spent 18 years as a management consultant, most of it focused on operational improvement at large-scale customers. I left McKinsey at the end of 09, early 2010, to start LeanTOS. The idea being, imagine delivering operational excellence, but delivering it on a software as a service platform. And so hence, Lean Transformation as a Service was the concept around which the company started. Initially, we were spread across multiple industries, but about 5 or 6 years ago, we pivoted to be entirely focused on healthcare. And so that's the 30-second version of the background where the company came from and is headed.
And why the pivot to only to just healthcare?
That's a great question. We initially thought that we would be building operational analytics using lean principles and delivering customized applications that were very problem specific. And so our initial clients were across a variety of industries. Google was a client, Flextronics was a client, Clorox was a client. So we were in banking, technology, insurance, et cetera. Even Home Depot was a client. What we found then, though, was while the approach worked, and so we'd perfected the model of sophisticated data, operational analytics, developing machine learning recommendations, and delivering it through a SaaS application, we felt no single solution was scalable. And so our idea was to build something that could really scale. And in that model, we ended up solving the infusion scheduling problem for the first time at Stanford Healthcare. And we realized that every infusion center in the country and on the planet probably faced that issue. And so we realized we'd found something and had solved a very hard problem that needed to be solved, and therefore pivoted the company and put all our energy behind it. Up until that point, we had only raised about $5 or $6 million. Once we pivoted, we've raised over $250 million since then. So it's an order of magnitude different in terms of scaling. The company was only about 20 or 25 people when we pivoted. We are over 200 people now, and so the decision to pivot was exactly right, and we followed it up with being able to deliver behind it.
So it sounds like you had a discrete success at Stanford in scheduling, in ironing out scheduling problems at an infusion center, and you had a bit of a aha moment. This is, and of course, you once you have success, you build on success. It sounds like.
That's exactly right.
So you have a pretty cool little tagline, better healthcare through math. I couldn't help but make a joke in sending some thoughts that in advance of this. It seems like you must be talking to Andrew Yang a little bit. But you're applying machine learning to healthcare. So I always like to, in these discussions, really sort of get the interviewee to define their terms, because people use expressions, bits of jargon in different ways. So I want you to tell me and anybody who's watching this, what exactly you mean by machine learning, and could you sort of unpack, perhaps referencing the success at Stanford, how you're applying that to healthcare?
That's very good. First, let me address the Andrew Yang thing, though. With all due respect to Mr. Andrew Yang, his math tagline was during the elections in 2019. We came up with better healthcare through math in 2016. So I just wanted to set the chronological sequence of that correctly from the beginning. That said, so how do we think about the application of machine learning? What we do is very sophisticated demand-side analytics to predict the volume of patients, the type of patient, the duration of their treatment, when they will show up, the propensity for them to run late, et cetera. So we get a very analytically sophisticated read on the upcoming demand signal for the rest of today, for tomorrow, for this week, for next month. So we're building out the demand forecast. We are understanding the supply side, because to deliver a healthcare service, you need the staff, you need the equipment, and you need the room. So for instance, if you're delivering infusion or chemotherapy, the pump, the drug, the nurse, and the chair have to all be ready, willing, and able at that moment in time. If the pump is broken, the drugs are late, or the nurse called in sick, or the chair is not being cleaned, that infusion isn't happening. So on the supply side, you've got predictive analytics that are constraint-based, because there are a finite number of each of these asset classes that all need to come together. Now you need to make the demand and the supply match in very tight windows of time, which is an incredibly hard math problem. It's got predictions and prescriptions and optimization and simulation, et cetera. So we do that. And based on that, we can recommend how the health system should use its assets. If it's an infusion chair, how they should schedule. On Mondays, you should offer up 1 hour treatments at 7:10, 8:20, 9:40, 10:30. You should offer up 2 hour treatments at 7:30, 8 o'clock, and so on. So we can guide them for every minute of every day, how they should offer up appointment slots in a way that maximizes utilization. So where does machine learning come into this? Because we've predicted into the future and we've offered up recommendations as to how they schedule, well, then they schedule as they're going to schedule. And things sometimes follow along and sometimes they don't. Sometimes our predictions are accurate and sometimes they're not. So we know at the start of the day how we predicted the day would go. And at the end of the day, we know exactly how the day went because we've got continuous data feeds. So our algorithms continuously look at what did we think would happen, what actually happened, and was that a one-off deviation or is there a systemic problem that causes us to tweak our algorithms, tune our models, refit our models, and therefore we can come back with template recommendations. So just like the Nest thermostat learns how you like to live, whether you like your bedroom cooler at night or warmer at night, and at what time you wake up and what you do, the thermostat starts to adapt to your lifestyle. Our templates adapt to the operation. So this is true of every one of our products. So for instance, the operating room product, we understand how long they thought a certain kind of case would go. And we've got very sophisticated categorization methods. So we don't just say a spine surgery. We know if it's a two-level fusion versus a four-level fusion. So we understand the distinctions between the surgeries. We categorize and classify correctly. And we look at the accuracy of their case length estimation by surgeon, by type of case. And based on that, the next time they're scheduling, we can offer them guidance. I know you think this is a two-hour case. I'd suggest you leave 2.5 hours for it. So our algorithms are learning in that way. Another example in the operating room, which is a very hard thing to operate and manage, is we look at how surgeons fill up their allocated time. So if I'm a surgeon who's going to do 6 surgeries today, let's say, the 6 patients will be on my table through the course of today. were people I saw as recently as yesterday who needed emergency surgery, or people I saw 4 months ago who scheduled their elective surgery that happened to fall today, right? So the way in which my schedule for today got constructed was a series of events that happened over the last several months. We can look at the pattern of how a surgeon tends to fill up his or her block. And if we notice that this surgeon usually fills up more than half their cases 4 weeks in advance, and we notice they've got a block 2 weeks from now that's lying empty, we can proactively ping them and say, Peter, you've got a block in 2 weeks. You normally would have filled up at least half of it. It's lying completely empty. Is it possible you won't be using it because you're going to be at a conference or you're going to be somewhere? So the machine has learned, and the pattern is unique to each surgeon. And at scale, it's automatically sending it out to all 1,000 surgeons. So this is impossible for someone manually every single day to be looking at all the upcoming blocks and run that pattern analysis. For beds, for example, every unit, so a hospital has many units. There's a 24-unit medical unit. There's a 10-bed GI unit, et cetera. So depending on the disease type and the part of the body, there's a different portion of the hospital. We understand how the admits flow into that unit and the discharges flow out of that unit based on historical patterns. So a machine can learn as to when orthopedics tells you they're going to discharge at 1, they always run 90 minutes later. Maybe it's because they need a physiotherapist, maybe because they need a wheelchair to be found somewhere in the hospital and brought open. They always run 90 minutes late on Tuesdays, they run 20 minutes late on Wednesdays. So based on that, our algorithm can correct what the stated discharge time is versus what the real discharge time is going to be, and therefore adapt. So all of these kinds of judgments are sitting in the heads of thousands of people, and we are able to bring that to bear in an automated, analytically rigorous way that guides the frontline. So that's kind of what.
Just a couple of questions. So does your machine learning and your software, does it ride within an EHR environment, or is this something that I would log on to separately? It would be a different app in whatever is part of my workflow?
That's a critically important question. We do not need to connect directly to the EHR. So we don't need EHR integration, which makes us EHR agnostic.
Phew.
this was not an accidental choice. This was a very deliberate business strategy and technology strategy decision. So we are EHR agnostic. We run on Epic, Cerner, Meditech, Pisces, iNomad, Centricity, Sorian, Mosaic, you name it. We've been running on 10 or 15 EHRs. What we do need is the data. So EHRs are excellent repositories of data. They've got every timestamp, they've got everything there. So we've built data pipelines that are at varying levels of granularity. So at the beginning, we get a 6-month data dump so we can tune our models and build the algorithms. Once we get going, we get an automated feed once a night after their database warehouses have synchronized. Typically, that's sometime in the middle of the night. We get an automated data push. Again,
So did you need, even if you're EHR agnostic, did you need to broker agreements with the major EHR companies for their data to pipeline into your algorithm?
Just to be clear, it's the hospital's data. It's not the EHR's data. The data belongs to the hospital. We are very clear about that. And so the hospital IT teams know how to pull the data out of their systems. And so the hospital IT team will pull the data out and push it to us. So the automated push every night is after the warehouses have synchronized, we've understood exactly the fields we want. We've helped the IT team write the script. That gets pushed to us. And then in most cases, we also get a real-time feed. There's a wonderful HL7 standard, which is a real-time feed. We listen for the scheduling interface, which means any adds, moves, changes, deletes of appointments, we automatically get pinged in real time. And so our algorithm gets all of that.
Is interoperability at all an issue with you and your company? And just to be clear, the name of the product, I believe, is IQ, correct?
IQ is the product suite. And so each specific asset has an IQ. So we've got IQ for infusion centers, we've got IQ for operating rooms, and we've got IQ for inpatient beds. And of course, we're doing research on IQ for on and on, all the other assets that matter. So interoperability is not a direct issue for us, in that interoperability is more about the patient having their medical record move with them in a portable manner, right? And so for us, when we encounter a health system, they've got an EHR. Sometimes they're in the middle of transitioning from one EHR to another. And because we are EHR agnostic, we can actually help them through the transition. We've had many cases of deploying a product in the first EHR. Some months later, they switch to the other EHR and we seamlessly cut over and they have continuity across the fissure of the first and second EHRs.
So the this podcast that I'm preparing this content for concerns itself with patient access. So in what way does your IQ suite of products help with patient access?
What we do is we unlock capacity. By using the magic of supply-demand algorithmic balancing and the ability to link disparate services into a seamless flow of a patient encounter. Because remember, a patient encounter is a series of connected events. They go to the lab, they go to the doc, they get a procedure done, they recuperate, et cetera. So by using our math to unlock capacity, we can systematically unlock 10 or 15% capacity in most of the assets we work with. Okay, so if you work with infusion centers, they should be able to see 10 or 15% more, complete 10 to 15% more treatments within the same cost envelope, meaning the same hours of operation and the same nursing staff. With the ORs, we can systematically improve the utilization of each and every OR by 5 or 6 percentage points during prime time hours, 7 a.m. to 5 p.m., right? So what happens when you unlock capacity? Unlocking capacity is the key to access, meaning I have more opportunities to create appointments today, tomorrow, this week, next week, instead of saying, sorry, I'm full up. The earliest I can give you is next month. So access is directly related to capacity. The more capacity you have, the more access you create. So in that way, we directly help our health systems unlock capacity.
So in some sense, if I'm understanding correctly, there's an efficiency gain here, and an infusion center that maybe was seeing 90 patients a week. Your company and the experience has shown could start to see 100 patients a week.
Exactly.
As a result of, in simplest terms, I know there's a lot of difficult math and a collection of data and whatnot. But in simplest terms, what you're doing is marrying demand with supply. Demand being patient need, supply being healthcare capacity, and getting them to match better.
Exactly. So let me give you a real life example that illustrates the complexity of that, because you're right, from 100,000 foot level, all we're doing is matching supply and demand. Think about what Uber has to do. Every minute of every day, on every street corner, in every major city of the world, they have to match the demand for a ride with the availability of a car and a driver ready, willing, and able to offer that ride within a 10-minute window. If they told you you have to wait 45 minutes for your Uber, you're out. Right? So what do? They don't just look at the calendar and say, John, go give Bob a ride. They build demand models forecasting the demand by zip code, by time of day, day of week, seasonality, weather, construction, etc. They understand the driving patterns of every driver, who drives at nights to make a few extra bucks, who drives during the day, which zip codes they cover, and they try and match that algorithmically. When it doesn't match, they intervene. They change the incentives to bring drivers out of the woodwork. They tell them, hey, double pay for the next 2 hours. Come on out and start driving. And they reposition drivers. They say, hey, you're hanging out on the west side of town. Go to the east side of town. The demand's a lot there. If that doesn't work, they delay demand. They do surge pricing so that the 10% of customers who are very sensitive to price will go get a coffee and look try again in 20 minutes. And so that's the level of upfront analytic intervention and in the moment, analytic real-time nudges on both the supply side and the demand side to make it happen. That's what it takes. Nothing like that exists in a health system. We've created that concept and that ability to intervene, but in an invisible manner. It has to be a bit of an invisible hand. It cannot be grabbing anyone by the throat and making them do appointments differently. It has to offer gentle recommendations and help them steer and lead them to a magical outcome without appearing overly in control of it.
Why does it have to be a gentle hand?
Because there are many, many clinical factors that go into making that decision that we simply don't know. So if we were to assert you must see Peter at 9 o'clock and not at 11 o'clock, we don't understand the five other factors that could change that decision. And so the final decision has to be in the hands of the frontline healthcare. We have to augment their intelligence, not replace their intelligence. So we cannot just prescribe. Uber just says, Bob, you're giving John a ride, and that's the way it is. Because there's no other factor. They just looked at distance, and it's
right. And I don't think we're at the point where you'd want to start building financial incentives into a busier surgical schedule because if something went wrong, it'd be horrendous. So,
more than financial, even clinical, we don't want to opine on clinical matters. Clinical matters are very complicated. They're multifactorial. They require deep, deep specialists with 30 years of clinical experience. We are not going to pretend our algorithms can do that. Our algorithms can make very good operational recommendations, and so they do. So what we do is we offer up an intelligent recommendation. We don't jam it down anyone's throat. So think of it like Netflix. It's understood your viewing patterns. It's understood the kinds of movies you like, the kinds of actors and actresses you like, and it offers up recommendations. It's not forcing you to see a movie. But its recommendations are pretty good because they understand you quite well. Amazon understands what you buy quite well. So in that sense, we do intelligent recommendations. We don't grab it and force it.
Some of us wish that Amazon and Netflix didn't understand us so well.
That's a different issue.
So patient access is often discussed in the context of disparity. And increasingly in 2021 in the context of racism. So I understand that you're dealing with patient access in terms of using existing capacity in a more efficient manner. Mm-hmm. But is there any way that your company and your product relates to patient access in this other context that has to do with disparity, justice, and racism issues?
That's clearly a very important topic. I'd have to say only indirectly, because what we do is we unlock capacity. When you unlock capacity, you have more choices, you have more appointments you could create. So it's up to the health system as to who they give those appointments to, what class of payer, what kind of class of insurance they do. We have nothing to do with that. But it's hard for us to claim any more credit in that front. And so I wouldn't want to overstretch or overpromise, because here are things we don't do. We have nothing to do with payers. We don't do anything on the insurance side, eligibility, co-pays, deductibles, the financial arrangements between the patient and the healthcare. We don't touch the revenue side at all. We don't touch authorization, benefit eligibility, et cetera. So those things actually drive access in a more fundamental way than capacity. It's just the ability to pay, the ability to be insured, the ability to be included. Those are bigger drivers when you talk about a systematic or a systemic disadvantage for certain classes of people to have access to healthcare. And we don't have any solutions in that space. So I'd not want us to claim that we can do more than we can do.
Of course, I admire your sort of holding back and not making claims that can't be supported. One could perhaps imagine a scenario where additional capacity at an infusion center might help a system begin to address issues of disadvantage, but it's kind of not in your sphere of influence or operation. So, of course, it's impossible to discuss healthcare today without asking an interviewee about COVID-19 and the role that if they're a company, if they're what their company is doing in this context. So we only have a few remaining minutes.
Yeah.
Did LeanTOS and your IQ suite come into play in a special way as a result of the pandemic? And was there any particular healthcare system that, you know, maybe used your product in a way that was in response to whatever they were experiencing because of the pandemic?
So stepping back a minute, what the pandemic has shown us is that when a system operates at the edge of capacity, and by system, I mean a healthcare system, either a local or a regional or a nationwide, when a system operates at the edge of capacity, a small shock could send it into gridlock. Okay? We all know this. When the freeways are chock-a-block full at rush hour, imagine if a football game let out on the freeway right at the same time. It's just 20,000 more cars, but it would send the whole system into a tailspin. What COVID did is it had massive shocks on both the supply side and the demand side. On the demand side, tens of thousands of people suddenly needed medical attention that they might otherwise not have needed. They needed to come in, be in the ICU, get treated, need ventilators. On the supply side, initially there was a shortage of PPEs, then there was a shortage of ventilators, then there was a shortage of beds. And so what COVID did is it had massive shocks on both the supply and the demand side. Now, the supply side, you can start to recover through planning. They've advanced ordered inventory. They've lifted it up. They've put in field hospitals. So it just takes time and planning, and you can get some supply in place. The demand side requires behavior change. You need millions of people to start doing things differently in order to start dampening the demand and lowering the infection rate. So we will be struggling with this, with recovering from the shocks to the system. And the magnitude of the shock determines how long it takes to recover from it, right? I mean, if you just put it in simple financial terms, if you operate your home finance budget with $100 left over at the end of each month, you can withstand a shock up to $100. You can't withstand a $1,000 shock. But the size of the reserve doesn't do anything. If you had $1 billion left, you can withstand $1 billion shock, but not a $2 billion shock. So no matter how big your reserve is, at some point, a shock can be too great. So that's kind of on the COVID side, what has to be worked through as a system. Now, what did we do? Very early on, we created free tools that we made available to everybody. Just everybody, not just customers. Tools to help calculate the backlog on surgeries. Because as surgeries are getting canceled, the backlog is growing. But someone who needed a heart surgery still needs a heart surgery. Even if you push it out by a few weeks, that's not going away. Someone who needs a knee replacement needs a knee replacement. And so given that the OR is quite stressed, how do you bring that backlog back? And so we created backlog calculator tools. With Infusion, we created how do you alter your templates in a world where every other chair needs to be left empty for social distancing so that two Infusion patients aren't sitting 3 feet from each other. And so we came up with all of these templates and backlog tools and made them generally available. We conducted a series of webinars where we offered up our perspectives on how to handle this. But more important than our perspective, we brought our customers. Our customers are the leading health systems in the country. We work with over 100 health systems in the country, half of the top 10, 12 of the top 20, and so on. We brought them to share what they were doing on monitoring, on testing, on managing shifts, on remote work, on patient isolations, etc. And those were very well attended. We'd have hundreds of people from dozens of health systems attend these webinars. So we shared all of those best practices. Finally, what we were able to do is take some of those tools and incorporate them into our products. So for customers who have our products, we were able to leverage the backlog creation and the backlog work through because we had all their data. And so it wasn't just a generic tool that everyone could use. It was a specific tool aimed at a specific one. To give you an example of one particular health system that responded very quickly during COVID, Novant Health in North Carolina. It's a massive health system. We'd been talking to them off and on for many months, but then when COVID hit, they suddenly had this urgent need to fix the OR utilization problem because they could see the backlogs building up. And so in a very short period, like 4 or 5 weeks, they agreed to launch our OR product across all 120 ORs at Novant Health. Up until then, our OR deployment required our team to be on site. Not a lot, but on site 2 or 3 days at a time for 5 or 6 weeks. So call it 15 team days on site, and a team would have been 3 or 4 people. So it's 50, 60, 80 FTE days on site. In COVID, no one's going on site. And so we innovated with them to make the whole launch remote and the whole launch accelerated. So when you step back and think of what happened at Novant, we went live in a 6 or 7 week period, all virtual, no one from our team set foot on property, 120 plus ORs scattered across 20 plus surgical sites with 300 or 400 staff members needing to be trained, all done. And it went off superbly. They've published about it. They've written articles about it. And they were very, very happy. And they also use our infusion products. So Novant's a very important partner. That's a microcosm or a small example of how we responded in COVID and adapted our delivery to meet the moment.
So we only have a few minutes left. A very generic and sort of softball question to wrap things up. So what's next for LeanTOS and your IQ suite of products? Is it a question at this point of getting more systems to use your product? Are you expanding, adding features? What, and try to avoid all of the above answer.
let me do two things to frame the answer. One is explain the size of the problem. Across the US, we have $2 trillion of healthcare assets, not counting real estate. There are 5,000 hospitals. Let's assume they each have $300 or $400 million worth of stuff. An OR is $15 million. An imaging machine is $1 million. So collectively, we've got $1.5 or $2 trillion of assets. The utilization in healthcare is worse than any other asset-intensive industry: airlines, transportation, shipping, etc. So if you could unlock 10 points of utilization by smarter supply-demand matching, you can create $200 or $300 billion of value a year, which is massive for the healthcare system. So that's our North Star. Now, let me paint a vision for what perfect looks like, or close to perfect looks like. Think about what happens to an aircraft when you are at the gate waiting to catch your plane. The plane pulls in, and in the space of 45 minutes, think about all that they do. They kick out 200 passengers, they put in 200 new passengers. They clean the cabin, they restock the food, they kick out 1,000 bags, take in 1,000 new bags, they check the engines, they refuel the plane, they check the flaps. All of that happened in 45 minutes. It happened 5,000 times a day in Atlanta. And it happens day in and day out at perfection levels, because 99.99% isn't good enough. That's still a dozen crashes a day. No one's going to put up with that. So what did they do? For each service, they match the supply-demand asset, the right number of baggage, carts, stores, tugs, ramps, people in each zone of the aircraft, because you cannot reposition those assets quickly. They got the choreography right. You have to clean the cabin before the new passengers come in, but you cannot start cleaning until the old passengers are out. So you've got to get the dance sequence of these various steps together. When you do it, it's magic, because Atlanta Airport in the 80s could do 500 flights. Today, they can do 5,000 flights. The airspace didn't change. The number of runways didn't change. That's our vision. So now imagine, asset for asset, we do exactly that. Brilliant supply-demand matching to optimize capacity, improve turnaround time, etc. We get the choreography between assets. So an OR patient who needs a bed, we can smoothly link their entire care journey correctly. And we cover assets by assets. We've got infusion, we've got OR, we've got beds, we've done work in clinics, we've done work in imaging, we've done work in radiation oncology, we're looking at emergency departments, we've done work in phlebotomy labs. So you start knocking off all the assets, you build the supply, demand, and mathematical linkages, offer up prescriptive recommendations to do this. Now you've got air traffic control in a health system. And imagine if we could up the velocity, 5x the number of patients with the same quality of care with less waiting time, that unlocks billions of dollars of value. So that's kind of what we're building towards. We're focused entirely in the United States. There are 5,000 hospitals here, 300 of them work with us. So we've got only 4,700 to go. And so that's kind of how we think about it.
And Are infusion centers still your strongest suit in terms of
At the moment, we are almost 50-50 between infusion centers and ORs. So if I think about the company, roughly half our size of the business in terms of revenues or customers or team size is almost 50-50. Beds is an emerging product. We just launched it in the fall of last year. So right now we are controlling 2,000 beds at 13 hospitals, 12 at one system and one large one at a different system. And so we expect that to grow. And by the end of next year, we think all three will be roughly the same size because the inpatient beds will grow rapidly. And then as new ones come, it typically takes us a year to build the product, a year to scale it up, and then it grows after that. So we've got the mechanics of how we do that quite well. And so that's kind of how we are resourced.
So what, we really only have a couple minutes left. So you paint an exciting picture of this incredible efficiency that will save money, mean more access for patients as a result of efficiency. Is the resistance here, either political, economic? What is going to keep this from happening, either done by you or a competitor?
Right, I think this is all new to health systems, relatively speaking, because health systems digitized their records less than 10 years ago, right? So in some sense, it's a new thing to them. Deploying applications that are in the cloud is relatively new to them. So they're learning as they go. So because it's relatively new, it's hard to tell the level of investment and effort it takes. So a health system might reasonably say, I've got three smart data scientists and I've got a couple software engineers who know how to do Epic report writing and Tableau and Power BI. Why can't I build this? So when I think about what stops us, I don't spend any time worrying about what other people are doing. It's just, how can we be persuasive to a health system that actually believes, hey, I've got this. And so we've got to be able to point out, yes, that's great. Those are great resources. But let me tell you the level of investment it takes to solve even one of these problems. So infusion, you might think it's a simple problem. Someone sits in a chair, you attach a pump, you flow some meds and they leave. How hard can it be to schedule? Well, let me tell you how hard it is. We've got a 50-person team working on it. We have spent $40 million solving that problem. We spend $15 million a year advancing that problem. No single health system will commit to spending $100 million over the next 4 years on infusion schedule optimization. So what we have to say is the three smart people building a template is not a scalable, enduring answer for you. So just like JP Morgan Chase that has 10,000 software engineers doesn't bother writing its own spreadsheet program. They go buy Excel from Microsoft and they pay $200 per employee to use it. Do they have the manpower to go build a spreadsheet competitor to Excel? Sure they do. Do they have the money? Sure they do. But they don't, because they understand that Microsoft will build it and sell it to 100 million companies around the planet and continue to put a level of investment in improving it that they as a single company would never put.
Thanks for listening, and keep an eye out for the next episode of the MHE Talks Improving Patient Access podcast series. Episodes to this podcast can be found on our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.